Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 347. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A quick programming note on next week's episode, Carney Wilson from Wilson Phillips. My childhood is here and it is real. But first, let's do this week's episode because we have so many amazing things in store for you with our guest. Let me introduce her. And it's going to be a long introduction, guest, so you might want to just chill out for a while. You've done a lot of stuff. Carrie Elleveld is a journalist and author and activist and a personal inspiration to yours truly. She covered Barack Obama for 4 years for The Advocate, first on the campaign trail and then at the White House, interviewing him 3 times. Including once in the Oval Office. Her 2015 book, Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency, is a must-read. I'm telling you, if you want to understand the landscape we see around us, you must read this book. Carrie has worked as a journalist in different media for 20 years. Since she began covering LGBT issues in 2006, she has won so many awards, including Best News Article in 2006 from the American Veterans for Equal Rights, first place in the 2007 Excellence in News Writing category, as well as the 2010 Sarah Pettit Memorial Award for Excellence in LGBT Media from the National Lesbian and Gay Journalist Association, and the 2011 Outstanding Digital Journalism article for her weekly View from Washington column from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and so many other awards that we don't have time to list. Carrie's work has appeared in Salon, The Atlantic, The Daily Beast, The Washington Post, and Politico. She has also been seen all over TV offering her insights on political developments to news outlets such as PBS, NewsHour, MSNBC, SiriusXM, The New York Times, Washington Post, The Associated Press. But right this second, Carrie is here with us. Carrie, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you for having me, Ken. That's quite an introduction. I feel pretty good about myself at the moment.
Carrie, that's all the time we have for this week's episode. It's been a treat chatting with you. My gosh. We have so much ground to cover, Carrie. Are you ready?
I'm ready, I think. I think I'm ready.
Let's find out. Let's do a little Carrie, This Is Your Life. Growing up there in Western Michigan, was this the dream? Was journalism the dream?
You know, journalism was not the dream at the time. What I did imagine and was, you know, was having a career. That I certainly did imagine.
Nice.
And I, you know, wrote poetry and things like that at a young age. And, you know, but I certainly didn't have in mind at a very young age being a journalist. And even when I became a journalist, I certainly never thought I'm going to write a book one day. I mean, that wasn't something that came to mind as a must, you know, like a bucket list type thing, must do. It's just something that I felt sort of obligated to try my hand at, given what a, you know, sort of amazing time period that I witnessed in LGBT history and American history.
Yeah. Was there a certain pivotal point where you just discovered, this is what I was meant to do? I am a journalist. I am an author. The written word is for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, when I first got out of undergraduate school, I moved out to LA to become an actress.
Nice.
like a lot of people. And frankly, my sensibilities were just so Midwestern at the time. It was really hard for me to take in LA. So I did a summer job there, and I made enough money to sort of move wherever I wanted to. And of course, I moved to South Carolina, because who wouldn't? I just had never seen the South, and I thought, well, I'll move there. Ironically, I moved from LA to South Carolina and ended up both coming out there and doing stand-up comedy there for a while. Not what most people would think of doing when they move from one to the other. And I started writing there, though. I mean, I started writing my own comedy routines, and there was a couple great sort of local newspapers that I volunteered to write for free, and, you know, got my byline out there a little bit, and then applied for an assistant editorship at a business journal in South Carolina. And they had seen my byline other places and hired me. And I will say, from that moment on, it just felt like a right fit. Just being, you know, writing, editing, being in the media landscape just felt like the right fit from that moment on.
Because I will say, our crack research team just looked you up on IMDb, and all we're seeing is a credit in the sound department as a sound recordist for His Name is Cosmo. I don't even know what that means, Carrie.
Well, now you're really digging up the dirt. Yeah, so after I had been a print journalist for more than a handful of years, I moved to the Bay Area and decided that I wanted to get into doing documentary film. So I went to school at UC Berkeley's journalism school to get my master's in the documentary film department. And, you know, while you're at Berkeley, they have a two-year program. You do writing and reporting, but then you also do a bunch of broadcast stuff. And I got out of there and knew how to do things like shooting, producing, sound, et cetera. And so when I moved to New York, I started picking up any job I could that would pay me. And one of the jobs that I picked up was on this particular film called Cosmo that was really a sort of a lesbian comedy about trying to figure out, you know, a new lesbian couple trying to figure out, you know, having sex. And Cosmo is the name of a dildo.
And there it is. And there it is. I'm feeling pretty comfortable, and you tell me if I'm wrong. I'm feeling pretty comfortable. This is the first time that's come up in an interview for you.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Ken, you got me.
Nice.
That's an absolute first. And the funny thing is that I'm actually really good friends with the person who hired me to do that. It was just a Craigslist thing. And, you know, I responded, and they needed a sound person, and I showed up. And so I'm friends with her to this day. And now she and her partner live out in the Bay Area, and we see them on a regular basis, my partner and I do. So
she's going to love the shout out. She's going to absolutely love the shout out. I think there's going to be a run on people trying to pick up that film now.
Yes. Well, her name is Nicole Opper. Just to give her a real shout out.
Nice.
Her name is Nicole Opper, and she's actually a fantastic documentary filmmaker. That was sort of a random thing that she did, but she's really a talented documentary filmmaker.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, it's not on your LinkedIn. I would add it. I would just put it on there. Now, let's go back to journalism. Let's just maybe take a step back and widen the lens a little bit. What would you say generally that you, Carrie Elleveld, are trying to do in the field of journalism?
Wow. So that has evolved over time, and it's something, you know, I've thought about a lot. I mean, my main commitment is to intellectual honesty. And regardless of which job I've done, I've always tried to do what the job calls for. And sometimes that evolves over time. So, for instance, you know, I don't consider myself a partisan. I mean, I don't consider myself a partisan Democrat. I'm clearly, you know, not a Republican. But, you know, I'm willing to criticize the Democratic Party when I don't think they're, you know, doing enough. I mean, I'm a progressive, and I will certainly identify as a progressive. And so I'm not going to sacrifice my progressive values, you know, for partisan takes. But initially, when I started out in journalism, I was like every other journalist. I sort of hewed to objectivity as closely as I could. And what started to challenge that is when I started covering LGBT issues in New York City. That was the first print job that I got there after I realized that I wasn't going to make very much money doing documentary film. And I was working for a local LGBT newspaper there called the New York Blade at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I approached that initially as though I was just a reporter on a gay beat, on an LGBT beat, and, you know, did my best to come up with good stories and whatever. And before I knew it, the next jump that I made was to The Advocate. And at that time, you know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were starting to duke it out for the 2007 nomination, or the 2008 nomination. It was in 2007 they started, you know, working at it.
Yeah.
And I started covering that incredible, epic battle between them for the nomination. And LGBT issues were just hot. They were front and center during that entire campaign. And that's part of the reason I had the chance, the opportunity to, you know, interview Obama. But what happened over time with that objectivity is that I started to lose it. You know, I always felt certain that LGBT Americans deserve the same rights as everybody else and deserve protections. But the more I covered them, the more I realized like how really, you know, screwed up the laws were and how much it was disadvantaging LGBT Americans nationwide. And the more I lived with that knowledge, the more I wanted to do the job for the constituency that I thought was necessary. And when I ended up having a front row seat, I moved to D.C. to cover the White House in 2009 when Barack Obama first took the Oval Office. I felt like what it was really my duty to do was still to expose the truth, but to try to figure out whether or not the administration was making good on the goals that President Obama had made on the campaign trail. And that I felt like, you know, I feel like journalists are always advocates for the truth. And that was the truth that I was trying to uncover.
Right.
And, you know, during that time, for the first 2 years, I was working for The Advocate, and I was entirely committed to that, you know, to trying to figure out that truth. And in trying to figure out that truth, you know, by virtue of doing that, advancing the goal of achieving LGBTQ rights for Americans nationwide. And then I resigned my post after the end of the first 2 years and after Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed. And I started working at Media Matters, at a division of the Media Matters called Equality Matters. And at that point, I dropped objectivity. And I really did consider myself an activist at that point, an activist journalist. And at that point, I really started to use whatever leverage I could to try to move the president on marriage equality, because I figured if he didn't come out in 2011 for same-sex marriage and supporting same-sex marriage, he wouldn't do it in 2012. I turned out to be wrong about that. I mean, you know, they ended up doing it in 2012. The back was just, you know, their backs were just so against the wall at that point, based on a number of factors. The states moving in the right direction on marriage equality, you know, Vice President Joe Biden saying what he did on Meet the Press, the polls moving in the right direction, you know, majority of Americans supporting marriage equality, all of those things played into Barack Obama coming out for marriage equality in 2012. But in 2011, I felt like the job called for impatience. And my commitment at that point were to the constituents that I had written for the past, you know, handful of years, and that I should do everything that I could, given my seat and given, you know, sort of the leverage that I had to try to move him in the right direction. And there were a lot of other people doing that. Certainly I wasn't the only one. But so as you can see, you know, what my commitment is to has evolved over the years. And there's no doubt that I lost objectivity. And I felt like given the seat that I was given and the seat that I had, that it was important to do the right thing for the constituency that I was writing for.
Amazing. Amazing journey. Let's talk about the book, Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency, in my hands right this very second. For our listeners who have never heard this, because this is one of my favorite things that I have read about, tell everyone where the phrase, Don't Tell Me to Wait, came from.
Well, that actually comes directly from an Obama quote during an interview that I did with him. And, you know, I was asking him whether or not in his, you know, during the campaign, whether or not his position supporting civil unions but not in favor of same-sex marriage was essentially, him asking the LGBT constituency to wait for a better time to, you know, come out for same-sex marriage. And he just absolutely rejected that flat out and said, I reject the, you know, the premise of your question. I can't remember. That might not have been exactly what he said, but then he did say, look, I'm ever mindful of Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, in which he tells the white clergy, don't tell me to wait for my rights. And so we literally took that. I mean, we went back and forth on a number of different possible titles, but my editor was one of the people who said, hey, you know, given some of the things you suggested, doesn't this direct quote really encapsulate what we're going for here? And I was in total agreement on that. So that's where that came from. It's a direct Barack Obama quote.
What did you learn about yourself putting this book together?
Let me say first what I think I learned.
Yeah.
Which is, as I was writing the proposal for the book, I was still in D.C. But by the time I was writing the book full time, I was in Berkeley. And there was something very intentional about that in terms of I didn't want to take all the sort of suppositions, all the things that I had come to believe from D.C. and just write this book with my knowledge having stopped at the, you know, in 2012, 2013 when I started writing the proposal. I wanted to go back and do what a good journalist should, which is challenge, you know, the assumptions, challenge the things that I thought that I knew. And so one of the things that I learned in going back and interviewing a lot more people and whatever is that the interesting thing about this time period is that everybody sort of turned out to be right. Now, my heart was definitely with, you know, started to be over time with the rebels, more or less. I mean, with the people who were really challenging the administration. I thought they were gutsy and they were doing something that needed to be done. But, you know, every person who worked on Don't Ask, Don't Tell mattered in the end. The people who played the real insider roles, who I didn't feel, you know, as compelled by as a journalist in some ways, they did their job when the job came time to be done. And the same can be said of the people who were working in the White House. You know, who the activists were really railing against. I mean, they did their job to the best of their ability. And everybody turned out to be right. We needed the outside push from the activists. We also needed the inside push. We needed the people who had, you know, 10 to 15 years on the Hill to do their job and make it possible for lawmakers to get Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal across the finish line, you know, in the final 4 days of the 111th Congress. So the insiders were right. The outsiders were right. A lot of people in the White House were right. Not all of them, because some of them were wrong. Yeah. But for the most part, everyone who had LGBT interests at heart really played the role that they needed to play. And I think that it was the activists who provided the special sauce. Sometimes I refer to it as that. You know, they were the people who provided the extra push that I honestly believe we wouldn't have gotten repeal through if they hadn't done the job that they did. But I felt like I learned, I gained an appreciation for the larger picture of all that happened. As far as what I learned about myself, you know, I learned that I have sort of a love-hate relationship with Washington, D.C. Yeah. I mean, it was an incredibly exciting time to be there while I was there, but it was also sort of toxic in a way. You have to make a lot of compromises to live in that city. And even as a journalist, you have to make a lot of compromises because there's a lot you know, as a journalist, people don't realize this. You end up keeping more secrets than you tell. And not because you're unethical, but because you are ethical, because you can't report things that you don't have, you know, multiple sources for. A good journalist doesn't do that. And so you end up knowing a lot of things that you can't actually print. And so that actually wore on me over time, as well as, you know, I think a lot of people then who were very pro-Obama or you know, whatever, felt like I had become a needle, you know, thorn in his side. And a lot of people who were very partisan Democrats felt like doing something like pushing Obama on marriage equality was going to absolutely doom him in the 2012 election. I didn't believe either of those things were true. But anyway, you know, I felt like I started to get pigeonholed into a certain type of personality, a certain, you know, whatever. And that was hard for me. I'm not really an activist by nature. I grew up in the Midwest. We're not super confrontational. I'm competitive, but not confrontational. And so, you know, in many ways, I left there to write the best book that I could. But I also think that, you know, for my own sanity, it was probably the best thing.
That's incredible text. Incredible text. Everybody go pick it up. Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency. Again, listeners, we are here with Carrie Ellivelle, journalist, author, activist, sound recordist. I'm going to add that every time I introduce you now. Talk to me about this latest piece. Well, it's probably not your latest piece. You put out so much content, which is so inspiring to me. One piece that particularly inspired me that you recently wrote was called The LGBT Movement is in Chaos. And you write about this push and pull between the national organizations and the grassroots movements. First, what prompted you to pen this piece?
Yeah, well, I pen some pieces still for The Advocate, even though I write for Daily Coast on a daily basis. And I wrote this piece for the print edition, and you know, you write a piece in the for the Advocate print edition, it doesn't get printed until, you know, 2 to 3 months later sometimes. So it's a little bit of a, I mean, it can be, you know, it can be hard to be current. But I think this piece, when it hit, was just as current as when I wrote it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for bringing it up. I wrote it because at the end of 2015, you know, we had made this amazing gain of getting marriage equality, and yet everyone in the LGBT movement knows how far we are from achieving full equality, and the hurdles, we're seeing the hurdles come up more and more with these, you know, horrific bathroom bills that are just, you know, ridiculous and also very corrosive at the same time. And so anyway, I was looking at 2015 and the whole year, and I was thinking, here we are coming out of this amazing amount of progress in 10 years. No one ever could have thought we would have gone from 2004, 2006, you know, passing 24 anti-gay marriage amendments to achieving marriage equality a decade later. And yet it didn't seem like we had a roadmap ahead. And, you know, frankly, I'm a little worried about the grassroots energy. I mean, I don't see the grassroots energy at the same level as you do say. I'm always comparing us against other movements, and yeah. I very much, you know, believe in the Dream activist movement, in the Black Lives Matter movement, in the climate change movement, reproductive rights, all these things, right? So I'm constantly keeping an eye on what they're doing, and at the moment, there's just so much more energy at the grassroots level from Dream activists, Black Lives Matter activists, in terms of the way they're participating and engaging with the candidates in 2016. I'd like to see more. I mean, there's been a few instances, but I'd like to see a lot more. And, you know, people seem to really be worried about there not being this definitive roadmap going forward. And that is problematic to some extent, but What I think is more important is not just that there's this definitive roadmap, because as you know, we've got the lesbians and the gays and the bisexuals and the transgender and queer activists and, you know, the intersex community. And, you know, you go down the line, there's just so many varied takes on what's the next step and what's most important. And I don't think there will ever be any one person or any one organization that completely encapsulates what everyone wants. And in some ways, that's been the strength of our movement, is a set of diversified point of views coming together, you know, sort of an emergent movement rather than something that's controlled by one singular entity. And what I think is most important in terms of progress is not that we have one singular vision, but that we have a robust grassroots movement that is pushing our organizations, including the Human Rights Campaign and Lambda Legal and the ACLU and, you know, gay and lesbian advocates and defenders and, you know, any number, the National LGBTQ Task Force, pushing them to do out of their comfort zones, to do things that they otherwise, I think, won't aggressively take on. And many of them are already doing good work. I think our legal advocates are doing amazing work.
Yeah.
But as we know, all of our groups are sort of naturally risk averse, and they all need to be pushed. And what creates, I think, the right atmosphere to get our greatest advancements is always the grassroots energy to challenge our national groups to be better, and a fair amount of chaos that comes with that. And that's okay. The chaos is okay. It's okay that we don't have a singular vision. What's most important is that we have people on the ground telling our national groups what they want and making it clear in no uncertain terms. And that's not always pretty.
Yeah. I encourage everyone to check out that piece. The LGBT movement is in chaos. In that piece, you said this, quote, "Unlike others, however, I don't see that lack of singular vision as cause for despair as much as an open-ended invitation to opportunity that beckons to each of us in our individual capacities." I really needed to read that right when I read that last week. You know, when we have all this angst going on, and certainly there was all the Hillary Clinton kerfuffle, which I think perhaps underestimates the kerfuffle around Nancy Reagan's comments and push and pull with Bernie Sanders, all these different pieces. And I needed to read that this is an open-ended invitation to opportunity that beckons to each of us in our individual capacities. So well said, Carrie.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for bringing up the piece. I mean, I really feel that it's incredibly important that everybody who has a stake in our movement, you know, do whatever they can. And I'm certainly doing whatever I can, and I make mistakes. I'm not perfect, but, you know, I do everything that I can with my writing to try to empower people. And I have to say, it's one of the biggest reasons that I wrote the book. I said I had witnessed something extraordinary, and that was what compelled me to write the book, or to try to write the book, because when you set out to write a book, you don't always know that you're going to complete it, right? And so, especially not a first book, it's a big endeavor. And one of the things I wanted to do more than anything was to get the word out that average people had affected the process. It wasn't just the people in Washington. It wasn't just the people on Capitol Hill. And it wasn't just the people at the White House. I really believed, based on what I saw, and I had, you know, a foot at the White House, inside the White House while I was covering the White House and going to the briefings, but also had a foot in the movement as I was covering what different activists and LGBTQ advocates were doing. And I became convinced that the average people who had been, you know, distraught at the passage of Prop 8 in Proposition 8 in California in 2008, and the fact that same-sex couples were stripped of their marriage rights, rights that they had already had in the state, that heartbreak really translated into something across the country for people and became a galvanizing moment. And people protested, and they knocked on doors, and they, you know, petitioned, and they wrote blogs, and they, you know, protested the president and at the White House gates, specifically. And that those were average people who did those things. You know, those weren't people in positions of power. They were people who took the moment into their own hands and did whatever they could in order to make their needs, their wishes, their urgency, the urgency of Washington. And a lot of my writing is about that. I kind of hit this theme over and over again and, you know, hope that it resonates. And I just think it's so important. It's one of the biggest reasons I wrote the book, is that so people could see what I saw in terms of the demonstration of average people taking their own power and using it to affect change.
Well, last question for you. Not if, but when we open the Elveld School of Journalism, I assume in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We'll see. We'll see where it gets placed. What?
Hometown.
There you go. There you go. Grand Rapids, Michigan, the Elveld School of Journalism opening soon. What is that one signature piece of advice that you are going to impart to all of your students as either a starting point or that guiding philosophy that they should keep in mind as they set out on that journalism path?
Always advocate for the truth.
There it is.
And sometimes that's your own truth, and sometimes that's other people's truth, you know? But if you're always advocating for the truth, then I think you stay within the mission of journalism.
Nice. All right, listeners, this is what you need to do. First, go on over to wherever fine books are sold and pick up Don't Tell Me to Wait, How the Fight for Gay Rights Changed America and Transformed Obama's Presidency. I'm telling you, it's a game changer. It gives you a sense, as I said at the start, of this landscape, of everything going on right now. It gives you that perspective. You must stroll on over to carrieelveld.com. We will certainly link to it, and you will get all of this content, everything that Carrie's working on. I have to tell you, Carrie, I have been following your writing for so long. There is such a clarity and a passion to the words that you put out there for all of us to consume. The truth is certainly at the heart of it, but the clarity and the passion really urge me to learn more about things going on around me. And I really thank you for that gift that you provided to us.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to interview me and reading my words. I always thank my readers, because unless you have readers, you're not relevant.
There it is.
And so anyway, I just really appreciate you having me on.
Carrie, please keep doing what you're doing.
Will do.
This is how it's always been. Sun comes up, the day begins. People come and then they go. I've been around long enough to know if you have a single seed, that's enough, that's all you need. And if you're lost in the night, keep the river on your right.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we definitely have time left on this week's episode to get to all the latest LGBTQ news out there, so let's do it. So much angst in the past week about Hillary Clinton and her comments at Nancy Reagan's funeral last week. So many news outlets have covered it, although when I mentioned it to many different folks actually over the past couple days, I would say the mainstream media didn't cover it as much, so a lot of folks not so much in the know. But in the LGBTQ community, you could not escape social media reference to Hillary Clinton's comments. She had said, she cited Nancy Reagan in particular, cited her as having very effective and low-key advocacy of HIV and AIDS research and treatment. Well, that's not exactly true at all. In fact, we could argue that is the opposite of true. So just 2 hours into the firestorm of backlash after making these comments, Hillary Clinton released remarks that ended with the quote, "I misspoke about their record on HIV and AIDS. For that, I'm sorry," end quote. Well, that apology about both Nancy Reagan and President Reagan was lambasted as tepid, and a few hours later, she took to Medium, which is a social media outlet, to pen an 800-word essay on the fight against HIV and AIDS. In the essay, she noted that she had lost friends and loved ones to AIDS. She celebrated the historic presence of HIV-positive speakers at the 1992 Democratic National Convention. She talked about how she would strategize and coordinate efforts with world leaders as First Lady. She talked about how she voted for various AIDS research bills as senator, and she mentioned how she was part of the Obama administration's broad push for an AIDS-free generation in her time as Secretary of State. Further, she even included the line, quote, "This issue matters to me deeply." So it's been a very big deal over the past 5 or 6 days, and many have argued that it affected their voting on this third Super Tuesday. I know that it definitely played into when I was standing there at the booth this week in Ohio, my first time voting in a swing state, so that was pretty exciting for me. And certainly the thought crossed my mind. I'm not going to say who I ended up voting for, but that definitely factored into my decision-making process as I was standing there. So a number of great op-eds out there. There's one over on out.com entitled, "Was Hillary Clinton's HIV and AIDS Apology Essay Enough?" And a nice move over on pride.com, and we do enjoy pride.com, they cited 15 AIDS activists who started a national conversation. So this was in direct response to Hillary Clinton's comments that Nancy Reagan was a very effective low-key advocate for HIV and AIDS who started a national conversation, when again, that is not the truth. The word AIDS, HIV, these were not mentioned until well into the Reagan presidency, and so many thousands of people had already died. So Pride.com put together a list of 15 folks, and I really encourage you to check these people out. And I'm going to name all 15, because that's what we do. We want to mention people that, hey, if you don't know this name, you need to look them up. Larry Kramer, you should know who Larry Kramer is. Paul Popham, who was one of the co-founders of Gay Men's Health Crisis. You definitely want to know about Paul. Paul Rappaport, he was an attorney and also a co-founder of the Gay Men's Health Crisis. Lawrence Mass, also a co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis, and he wrote the first press reports on the AIDS epidemic. Keith Haring, an absolute hero of mine, American artist and activist Keith Haring. Marsha P. Johnson, a veteran of the Stonewall riots and a co-founder of the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, and also an AIDS activist with ACT UP. Greg Gonsalves, he was an AIDS activist who began working with ACT UP in 1990. Spencer Cox, also involved in ACT UP and Treatment Action Group. Kiyoshi Koremiya, a Japanese-American author and civil rights activist who was involved in civil rights, anti-war, and AIDS activism. Look him up if you don't know him. Mark Happel, who was an artist and activist with visual AIDS. He came up with the Red Ribbon. Arnold Jackson, writer and activist Arnold Jackson, a member of Philadelphia Black Gays, Inner Pride, the Colors Organization, and Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health. It's a lot of work happening in Philadelphia. Terry McGovern, who founded the HIV Law Project in 1989. Reggie Williams, an AIDS activist in San Francisco in the late 1980s. Jean Carlomusto, who documented the AIDS crisis for 30 years and was a member of ACT UP. And finally, David Wojnarowicz, who was a painter, writer, photographer, filmmaker, performance artist, and AIDS activist. He famously wore a jacket to the FDA action by ACT UP that said, "If I die of AIDS, forget burial, just drop my body on the steps of the FDA." If you don't know some of those names, look them up. We always want to give voice to names that we should all know about. So that's all the drama that surrounded Hillary Clinton's comments at Nancy Reagan's funeral, but so much other news out there. In Kentucky, Kentucky's Republican-controlled Senate this week approved a license to discriminate bill that would allow individuals and businesses to deny service to LGBT people without being penalized under local anti-discrimination ordinances. Senate Bill 180 passed by a vote of 22-16. The bill's lead sponsor, Republican Senator Albert Robinson, contends that the proposal is not discriminatory. He says it's not discriminatory. He said, rather, it's necessary to protect people of faith from LGBT people who, quote, are trying to force their beliefs down the throats of those who act upon their religious convictions. So there you go. If you're thinking, wow, that sounds discriminatory, no. Republican Senator Albert Robinson says it's not. The bill now moves on to the House, where Democrats hold a 6-seat majority over Republicans. If passed, the legislation would amend the state's 2013 Religious Freedom Restoration Act to assure that it applies to providers of goods and services to the public, putting their work under the Protected Activities Clause of the law. Anyone acting on a sincerely held religious belief, whatever the heck that means, anyone acting on a sincerely held religious belief would be protected from being fined, imprisoned, held in contempt, or otherwise punished for acting in accordance with those beliefs. There you go. Sincerely held religious belief. I have absolutely no idea what the bellwether is for determining that. I guess we'll find out if that goes through, but hopefully with Democrats in control there by 6 seats, it will not go through. Back to the presidential front, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, he loves getting his endorsements. Every week we tell you about a different anti-gay endorsement that he gets. He just got another one. Yay! Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, he got a new endorsement from ex-gay activist and founder of the anti-gay Christian group Mission America. Love that name. Mission America sounds great. No, it's an anti-gay Christian group. That would be Linda Harvey. She announced her support for Ted Cruz, lamenting that, quote, a weak Republican just won't do when it comes to protecting the most vulnerable among us, the unborn. Harvey's endorsement was co-signed by Phil Burris of Citizens for Community Values Action, which is the Ohio chapter of the anti-LGBT hate group Family Research Council. Also signing on to Harvey's endorsement was Molly Smith, head of the Cleveland Right to Life, right here in Cleveland, Ohio, whose anti-gay activism has sometimes been too extreme, even for fellow pro-lifers. Less than 24 hours before we all voted here in Ohio, the Cruz campaign formally acknowledged acknowledged Harvey's endorsement along with other key Ohio endorsements from dozens of Buckeye State Christian and conservative activists. And Ted Cruz said this, quote, "I am thrilled to announce such outstanding endorsements from Ohio leaders. These are some of Ohio's top conservative leaders, and they add to our incredible list of courageous conservatives from all across the Buckeye State." Just to remind you, Harvey is best known for her outspoken advocacy of the debunked and harmful practice sometimes called conversion therapy, which aims to make LGBT people straight and cisgender. So I'm excited to come back to you all next week and let you know which anti-gay person is the next one to endorse Senator Ted Cruz. He loves it. He loves these anti-gay endorsements, and they love endorsing him. Big news out of the White House. For 21 years, the White House's LGBT liaison has either been a straight woman or a cisgender, non-trans, gay or lesbian official, but Rafi Friedman Gerspan just changed all that. Friedman Gerspan is a trans Latina public policy expert who was first appointed to a staff position in the White House last year. Now she becomes the first out transgender person to serve as the White House's LGBT liaison. Her official title is Outreach and Recruitment Director for Presidential Personnel and Associate Director for Public Engagement. This is great news. Formerly the Racial and Economic Justice Initiative Policy Advisor at the National Center for Transgender Equality, Friedman Gerspan is no stranger to breaking barriers. She was the first transgender woman to work in the Massachusetts House of Representatives, where she was instrumental in passing the state's transgender equal rights law. Friedman Gerspan's work has garnered high praise for her ability to connect issues of racial and economic justice with LGBT concerns. Senior Obama advisor Valerie Jarrett told The Advocate this when Friedman Gerspan was first appointed to the White House in 2015. Valerie Jarrett said this, quote, "Rafi Friedman Gerspan demonstrates the kind of leadership this administration champions. Her commitment to bettering the lives of transgender Americans, particularly transgender people of color and those in poverty, reflects the values of this administration." So huge congratulations to Rafi Friedman Gerspan, a trans Latina public policy expert who now becomes the first out transgender person to serve as the White House's LGBT liaison. Fantastic, fantastic news there. Over in Oklahoma, this is fantastic news. All of our attention has been elsewhere, but LGBT advocates in Oklahoma scored a major, major victory. Freedom Oklahoma, the state's LGBT equality group, announced last week that the record-breaking 27 pieces of anti-LGBT legislation introduced this session had all been defeated. Look at that. Freedom for All Americans, the LGBT advocacy group that emerged from the now-shuttered group Freedom to Marry, notes that Oklahoma had one of the most aggressive packages of anti-LGBT bills in the country. The Sooner State had the dishonorable distinction of introducing the most anti-LGBT bills in a single session of any state legislature to date. Much of the legislation was championed by noted anti-gay Republican Representative Sally Kern. Oh boy, has Republican Representative Sally Kern come up a lot on this radio show over the past 7+ years. Sally Kern, she has previously equated gay people with terrorists, and last session introduced 3 anti-LGBT bills all on her own. Zach Ford over at Think Progress has a comprehensive accounting of the more than 24 bills introduced, including so-called religious freedom bills that opponents branded a license to discriminate, anti-trans bathroom bills, and what Zach Ford calls a novel attack on youth. House Bill 3044, introduced by Representative Sally Kern, sought to prevent any school counselor, therapist, administrator, or teacher from providing students with any guidance or information about human sexuality without notifying their parents. In other words, school officials can do nothing, Zach Ford notes, to affirm LGBT students without outing them to their families. But the great news out of Oklahoma, out of that Sooner State, is that the record-breaking 27 pieces of anti-LGBT legislation introduced this session, they have all been defeated. Well done, everybody there in Oklahoma, certainly everybody working at Freedom Oklahoma, who spearheaded so many efforts to defeat all 27 bills. 27 bills! It's a lot of bills. It's a lot of bills. That's a lot of time spent on ridiculousness, as if there are not other issues going on. By the way, it's not like there aren't other states spending their time on ridiculousness. Let's talk about Missouri. After a week where Missouri state senators spent well over 40 hours filibustering and eventually passing a sweeping anti-gay constitutional amendment, the state's Democratic governor lamented that the contentious proposal is a distraction from what really matters. Governor Jay Nixon told reporters at the end of last week that Senate Joint Resolution 39, which seeks to amend the state constitution to protect religious individuals and businesses from having to serve same-sex couples, effectively hijacked more pressing issues on the legislative agenda. He said this, Governor Nixon, quote, "It just shortens that field again and takes away the focus of what they said are their priorities this year. I just want to reorient folks here as to what we need to get accomplished." Among those accomplishments that got sidelined were a series of ethics reforms, which Nixon said the Republican-led legislature had frequently touted as a top priority during the opening days of this year's session. Governor Nixon went on to say this, quote, "We started out with a cavalcade of speeches and press releases and bills. All this number one priority, got to get this stuff done. Nobody talked about ethics reform this week." So we are still keeping our eyes on SJR 39. Last week, Republican members invoked a rarely used legislative maneuver to break the minority party's filibuster. And after another 8-hour filibuster the following day on Thursday, they voted to send the proposal on to the House for consideration. If passed by both chambers of the Republican-dominated legislature, the resolution would go before Missouri voters, asking them to amend the state constitution to protect, quote, "certain religious organizations and individuals from being penalized by the state because of their sincere religious beliefs or practices concerning marriage between two persons of the same sex." This is what they are spending their time on in the great state of Missouri. And the governor, among many other people, but certainly Governor Nixon there in Missouri, laments, why are we spending time on this when there is so much actual work to get done? So that's in Missouri. Let's turn to athletics, two athletic stories for you. When the Seton Hall Pirates take on the Gonzaga Bulldogs this week in Denver, Colorado, Derek Gordon will become the first openly gay basketball player to take the court in an NCAA tournament game. This is a huge deal. Gordon accomplished this milestone after Seton Hall stunned number 2 Villanova in the Big East Championship last Saturday. This will actually be Gordon's third appearance in the NCAA tournament. In fact, he is the first player in NCAA history to make the field of 64 with three different teams. He also made it as a freshman with Western Kentucky in 2012, then again 2 years later as a redshirt sophomore at the University of Massachusetts, but he hadn't come out yet in either of those appearances. He didn't come out to his appearance or to the public until a couple of weeks after UMass was upset in the first round of the NCAA tournament by Tennessee. He told OutSports this, quote, "Most of the time when you see me on campus, I'm alone. I eat alone a lot. Since the school year started in September, I haven't been to one party. I'm always working out or lifting or in my room. I do the same thing over and over every day. I feel like I can't be who I am or live my life." He was speaking about the isolation that he felt while he was in the closet and trying to hide his true identity. But once he did come out to his teammates, he received a flood of support, and as the first active Division I men's basketball player to come out, he also received a ton of attention. He surprised even those close to him when he decided to transfer away from UMass after the 2014-2015 season, but he said he was looking for a bigger platform. So there you go. Congratulations to Derek Gordon, the first openly gay basketball player to take the court in an NCAA tournament game. That's basketball. Let's talk about baseball for a second. Not a great story. A gay Cardinals minor leaguer says he quit baseball after hearing homophobic comments from teammates. In a report also on OutSports, pitcher Tyler Dunnington said the anti-gay remarks proved to be the breaking point following years of listening to bigoted comments in locker rooms over his career. He retired ahead of 2015 spring training. The Cardinals drafted Dunnington in the 28th round of the 2014 Major League Baseball Draft, a signing him to the franchise's Gulf Coast League squad and later the AAA affiliate of the New York Pennsylvania League. Dunnington went 4-2 with a 3.02 ERA in his year in the minors. Dunnington, who only recently came out as gay, was still in the closet at the time these incident occurred. He said he regrets not standing up to the homophobia and acting as a role model for other gay athletes. He said this quote, "I not only wanted to share my story, but also apologize for not using the stage I had to help change the game." So clearly a lot more work to do there in the sport of baseball and, you know, athletics in general. Stepping away from athletics, let's look abroad for a second. Botswana's highest court, Botswana. When have we talked about Botswana before? Botswana's highest court this week rejected an attempt by the government to ban a gay rights lobby group, providing a rare victory for African gay rights campaigners on a continent where homosexuality remains highly contentious. The president of the Court of Appeals, Judge Ian Kirby, upheld a 2014 lower court judgment that the lesbians, gays, and bisexuals of Botswana should be allowed to register and campaign for changes in anti-gay legislation. Judge Kirby said this, quote, "It is clear that the government's decision to seek the ban interferes in the most fundamental way with the respondents' right to form an association to protect and promote their interest. The ruling is a challenge to an anti-gay agenda pursued by the government of President Ian Karma in Botswana, where engaging in homosexual acts does remain illegal." So let's keep in mind that that's the actual landscape going on in Botswana. So much work left to do in Botswana, but a little bit of good news. One step. It's something. It's not a lot. I know, it's not a lot, but it's something there in Botswana. Let's turn our attention to Ireland. The Court of Appeals in Belfast has ruled that Stormont's health minister should decide whether a lifetime ban on gay men giving blood in Northern Ireland should be lifted. This means that the United Kingdom's Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt will not have any input into this decision in the future. In England, Scotland, and Wales, men can give blood if they have not had sex with another man for at least a year. In Northern Ireland, there is a lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. The court dismissed an earlier ruling that former Health Minister Edwin Poots had acted irrationally or with apparent bias by keeping the ban in place. The judges also held in this case that there was no basis for concluding that Mr. Poots' decision had been predetermined by his Christian beliefs. By a 2-1 majority, the judges concluded the current maintenance of the lifetime ban was not disproportionate or contrary to European Union law. The ban on gay men donating blood, which was put in place during the 1980s AIDS threat, was lifted in England, Scotland, and Wales in November of 2011. The courts in Northern Ireland have been deliberating the issue for the past 5 years. Previous health ministers Edwin Poots and Jim Wells had said that the prohibition should be kept in place in Northern Ireland on the basis of ensuring public safety. Let me just say this, folks, you have to keep talking about the blood ban because people really don't know about it. Every single time I talk to a group of people about either a lifetime ban on gay men giving blood, as exists in Northern Ireland, or the U.S.'s current practice, as exists in other parts of England there and in Scotland, of allowing people to donate blood if they've been celibate for a year, which for many people is a lifetime ban on giving blood, not because we're all out there having sex all the time, but just because it's actually not part of an individual's normal process of sexual relations to be thinking, huh, I should probably not do this because I would like to give blood in a year. That doesn't really factor into the relationships that we have with other people. It doesn't really factor into philanthropy. Just yesterday, I had the great opportunity to speak to the Psychology Club of Baldwin-Wallace University, a great group of students who are doing incredible work to highlight issues that are happening all over American and global society having to do with psychology of our vulnerable brothers and sisters. And yesterday's focus was on LGBT issues. And I certainly mentioned the blood donation policy here in the U.S. and just asked, there were like, you know, 20, 25 people there, just asked, hey, how many of you didn't know about that? and there were certainly 7 or 8 people who didn't know about it. And that was a pretty self-selecting audience. That was a group of students who were coming to an event knowing it was going to be an LGBT event. So they were disproportionately knowledgeable about LGBT issues. And even among the disproportionately knowledgeable community, still a huge chunk of them absolutely did not know about the current practices in place around the blood policy. So even if now there are 7 students at Baldwin Wallace University who now know that there is this deferral period that absolutely is ineffective, like it just can't work. It doesn't factor into how we establish relationships with other people or how we approach philanthropy. If there are now 7 people who didn't know before I spoke to them, who now know about this, who will now tell more people, that will have a great effect. That's more than did know before I spoke. And you have to do the same thing. You have to mention this to other people. Yes, marriage equality, it's great. There are other issues on the table here. We have to keep talking about conversion therapy. We have to keep talking about adoption. We have to keep talking about all the policies that we need in place for job protection, for housing protection, public accommodations, whatever it might be. We have to keep talking about this because the complacency that happened after marriage equality has affected all of these other areas that are struggling to get their issue on the table. And some of these are life-threatening issues. The dearth in blood donation is a life-threatening issue. The blood supply is dangerously low in the United States. I wish that I could donate blood. I have that type of blood that would help all of you out. But I can't give it to you because I'm not certainly thinking about in my life, oh, wait, I shouldn't have sex for a year because I would like to donate blood. I don't think I can be faulted for that. So keep talking about it. Keep talking about it. Hey, I will highlight some great news. A new study that was just released from the CDC shows how far attitudes have shifted in the positive for Americans who have grown increasingly supportive of gay and lesbian adults adopting kids. In a survey completed in 2013, whose results are now just being analyzed, nearly 75% of women said they agreed that gay or lesbian adults should have the right to adopt children. That's up from 55% in 2012. That's a huge increase. Men aren't as accepting as women, but it's still a huge increase. Only 68% of men said that they're in support of gay or lesbian adults having the right to adopt children, but that 68% is up from 47% 10 years prior. Look how much progress is being made. Even though men lag behind, the results depict a major shift over a decade, with acceptance growing from a slight majority of the population to closer to 3/4 of the population. That's in one decade. I feel so fortunate that I am alive to see all of this progress. It's amazing. That is amazing. Approvals of same-sex relationships also grew, hitting 60% among women and 49% among men. Given recent major political shifts, like the Supreme Court ruling legalizing gay marriage nationwide, you know, in June 2015, remember? It's possible that these figures have grown even further since. Because again, this is a 2013 survey that we've just finished analyzing. That's how long it takes. If you're not in the research world and you're wondering, what the heck? Where's the current research? It takes this long to crunch those numbers and draw the conclusions. We want that to happen. We, of course, would love if it was instantaneous, but this is how long it takes. That means it's good data. So it's possible that since this survey was completed in 2013, that acceptance both for adoption and just general acceptance of same-sex relationships has probably grown even more since June of 2015 when the Supreme Court issued their ruling. Many states like Mississippi still have laws that prohibit or limit same-sex couples from adopting, so shifting views on adoption are every bit as important as advocates continue to press for equality. And you, my friends, have a huge part in making that happen. You have to use your voice. Do it like Carrie Elleveld is doing it. Whether you are a writer, an author, whether you're using your voice to do a radio show, whether you are organizing a movie night in your community to just get people talking, whatever it might be, it is so critically important that you get out there and use your voice to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters and all of our allies out there who are fighting alongside us. You have a part in this. Great. Listen to this radio show week in, week out. Go on over to thisshowisogay.com and subscribe on iTunes, you'll get this show every single week. But after you listen to the show, then it's on you. Get out there and talk to one other person about it. That's the bare minimum. After you educate yourself, talk to one other person, and then push it further and talk to more folks. That's how we make a difference. It has been a pleasure. As always, our huge thanks to Carrie Elleveld and all the incredible work that she has put out there to this world, and our thanks to you for listening. Get out there and make a difference. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?